Welcome to Love Nature, a presentation of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. In this episode, we have the conclusion of our conversation with Dr. Kirsten Page, an assistant professor of musicology at North Carolina State University. We would appreciate it if you would share this podcast and subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can find Love Nature at love-nature.org, and you can explore our museum at naturalsciences.org. Now, here are our hosts, CEO and Director of the Museum, Dr. Eric Dorfman, and Chief Veterinarian and Director of Veterinary Sciences, Dr. Dan Dombrowski.
With your sort of understanding and appreciation, I would say, for the power of music and sound and soundscapes. So when you hear a commercial or watch a movie, are you like immediately like, you know, this is good because the sound and the music is making it? I mean, is a flop because they have a terrible soundtrack?
Well, I think that I sometimes feel kind of attuned to the kinds of like the associations they're assuming you're going to make with the music. And the fact that that when you're listening to music in a film, you're meant to be making associations with something that you might imagine is already associated with that music. So for example, in Lord of the Rings is a great example of this, because that music is, it's like, it really sounds like something that you might've heard like 100 years ago that was like mountain music, like the big dude mountain music from like around 1900 that was supposed to be all like very, very heroic. Yeah. So something like Strauss, for instance, I feel would have really gotten with the Lord of the Rings soundtrack.
that's right.
Like, yeah, these are like dudes going up a mountain, and it's supposed to show how like the vastness of space and the heroism of people who go up that mountain. And I feel like the people who create that music are assuming you're going to have some musical vocabulary and some knowledge that's allowing you to make those associations, I think. And so they're tapping into those existing paradigms that are in your head. As somebody who's just like listened to music and films, like even if you don't listen to Strauss or Wagner or something, you'll still, that music has trickled into film scores so much that it's already there. Like John Williams is amazing, he is a Wagnerian. He's a Puccini guy. Like it's obvious. Right. And so I think you already know what these associations are with this music. Even if you don't know that you're listening to something that sounds like Puccini or Wagner. So I think that I tend to think about that quite a lot, is like, what do they want you to think and feel when you're listening to this based on other music that I know, where I know what it's meant to evoke. But I think that a lot of students like to talk about like horror films and films that are meant to really get your blood pumping when we're talking about Wagner and the way he's trying to kind of like control how you're reacting. Cause he's a very coercive thinker. And like somebody like Nietzsche believed that Wagner's music was like a narcotic, that it intoxicated you, that it took away your free will. So students tend to be like, oh, this is a bit like in horror films where no matter what you do, if you're listening to the soundtrack, you're going to start having a physical reaction. And I think that's a very Wagnerian thing as well. And then if you switch it off, like you see that you don't have the same reaction at all when you're not listening to the music. So I think that lends some credence to Wagner's thinking, actually, that music really can have forced you to have a particular reaction, that it can control the way that you feel and the way that your body is even working in the moment, which is pretty wild.
I can see that. And well, it's interesting too. You know, I was thinking about, again, while we were preparing for this, thinking about the relationship of music like that to, say, a fire alarm, right? Which I'm not, you know, comparing them sonically, obviously, but they're both designed to give you a reaction, right? A fire alarm is saying, get the heck out now. And there is this sense of manipulation, right? And whether it's to save your life or make a philosophical point or just to keep you engrossed in a horror movie, you know?
Yeah, I think that's true. And actually that's an example I talk to students about sometimes at the beginning of the semester. I like to talk with them about the way that they listen. And I ask them to read Michel Chion's article called The Three Modes of Listening. And he talks about both musical listening a little bit and also just listening to ordinary sounds. And so the three modes for him are semantic listening, causal listening, and reduced listening. So semantic listening is when you listen for the most literal meaning of a sound. Right. So if you're just listening to somebody talking, you're just listening to literally what they're saying. Causal listening is trying to listen for the source of the sound. And then reduced listening is listening for the character of the sound. And we tend to combine these modes of listening when we listen. We don't really tend to separate them out. We try to always think of examples of separating them out in class, but it's tough. But something like a fire alarm, I mean, you know, maybe you use semantic listening. And you're like, okay, I know what this means. Literally, it's that I have to leave. And it has that very sharp sound to it. So you want to leave because you don't want right, to be around yeah. that sound anymore. But yeah, it definitely is. I think that when somebody decides, like, what is this going to sound like to get the reaction that I want, they think about how somebody listens and maybe think implicitly about those modes also to try to figure out how to get the reaction that they want. And in a horror film, it's kind of a similar thing, I think, like thinking about how is somebody going to listen to this? How do I get the reaction I want? And maybe those modes of listening come into play a little bit there too.
Right.
You said growing up, your dad was a musician. And so you sort of grew up with that in your house. I will say that my dad was not a musician. And I did not grow up with that in my house. In fact, my dad was a machinist. But my point being, the only Wagner that I'm familiar with is The Ride of the Valkyries. And that immediately brings to in my mind, an image of Bugs Bunny and me on, you know, our old couch when I was 10. So there's just so much power there. You know, again, it goes back to the power of this music and sounds, whether it's climate or the environment or in this case, you know, cartoons incorporating these same ideas. What do you think about that for age and young people, you know, the age of the audience? Do you think that it's really important or really powerful, I guess, to get these to young people? Is that when these, you know, these memories and associations are made?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think I first went to see Das Rheingold when I was in high school, and it really, really stayed with me. I think that I found the music to be so powerful, the story to be very, I mean, like weirdly, now that I think of it, I felt that the story was easy to follow, even though it's not. Like no, right. The Ring is one of the toughest to follow stories. Yeah. It's completely nonsensical. But actually just Rheingold, I think I felt like the characters are really interesting and you can kind of follow what's going on. I think that that's a good first Wagner opera in some ways, if you just take it out from everything else, from the later operas in The Ring. But I think that the music really obviously it's so strong. It's so powerful. It's so evocative. It does everything that he wanted it to do in the sense that it really you feel swept up in it. You feel like it's enveloping you. And especially if you go see it in a really great opera house that has good acoustics, you really, really feel totally embedded in it. And the story is interesting. And I think in particular nowadays that a lot of kids probably would have seen Lord of the Rings or Star Wars or something that has some similar ideas, that they will probably think it's kind of like that, which could maybe be good in terms of getting them interested in going to another opera. And I think one of the biggest issues for Wagner though, is that it's probably too long for most kids. So Rheingold is not super long. But if you had a kid sit through Die Meistersinger, it's about 6 hours. So I don't think
they could do that.
Yeah. Did they do a one-day match?
Yeah. when you were a kid, Eric,
I don't think I saw Meistersinger as a kid. I've certainly sat through The Ring and the first time fidgeted a lot. I think you have to mature into it. I'd say you want, you know, like, I think you'd want to start with like, I don't know, Magic Flute or something. if you're introducing a kid to opera, because you know something that's just fun and silly and has great catchy tunes and doesn't have but there's certainly a lot there. I mean, it's an incredible piece of music. Can we stick with opera for a little bit? You were talking a few minutes ago about modern opera and where the genre is going when we're talking about climate change and maybe we'll say environmental sensibilities generally, and whether or not whether this is calling for a new mode of communication perhaps. And I know you've written about CO2 and the Anthropocene, two operas, it's just Anthropocene. I just wonder if you'd talk about those a little bit. Those two operas.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, there have been a number of operas written recently, probably more than I even am aware of, that are about climate change and the Anthropocene. And they approach those topics in a lot of different ways. And I think it show how just how like all the vast possibilities of opera and how it can communicate. And Anthropocene is interesting. It's a story that's basically about scientists who get caught in the ice. It's not, I don't know that it's really clear exactly where they are. Maybe somewhere in the Arctic, they get stuck in the ice. Their ship is called Anthropocene. And they basically are trying to figure out how to get out. And they end up finding this woman who's, I think, a sort of indigenous person, maybe, who's been like trapped in the ice. And eventually she escapes and she's called Ice. So there's a lot of symbolism in this one, I think. And it was performed at the Scottish Opera, I think, in 2019. I think it was pretty popular. And I think that people took a lot away from it, imagining that it really did speak to climate change in some ways. And this sort of feeling of helplessness, I think, in particular. And I think that's something that opera can be good at, is evoking those kinds of emotions, even if the story itself might not always feel like really logical, which is kind of common in opera. But even if the story isn't necessarily telling you something about climate change that you feel is really representative about some, is kind of connecting with your life in some way, that feeling of helplessness is something that I think anybody could identify with in terms of these crises we're dealing with today. CO2, I think, is also really interesting. It's kind of this collection of scenes that are all about the history of the planet, really, and about the climate crisis, the causes of it, and people sort of not really caring about it, the sort of sense of politicians maybe not doing as much as they should, the sense of people just kind of going about their lives. So there's all these different scenes. And something interesting about CO2 is that it is performed in multiple languages. So the scenes are in different languages, and there aren't, I don't think that there's consistent subtitles through the opera. Oh, so right. It's meant to feel chaotic. And I think that when I've shown it to students, they do feel like they don't know what's going on. And I've actually said, like, I know you feel disoriented by this, but do you think that's part of the point? And so I think that opera can actually make people feel disoriented. It can make people feel helpless. And I think that that's a good thing. And in that sense, it's a really it can be a powerful medium for talking about climate change. There's also a great opera called Sun and Sea that was performed in Brooklyn. It was also performed in Venice. It's been performed in a few places over the past few years. And it's Lithuanian, actually. And the idea of Sun and Sea is really fascinating, because it's not performed on a stage. It's performed like in the sand pit, kind of. And you're meant to walk around the top of it. Oh, wow. As the audience members, and you can kind of come in and out whenever you want to. And the singers are lying in the sand pit, and it's meant to just be a day on the beach, basically. And they're all singing about just their lives, and they're not really focused on the fact that the tide is coming in closer to them all the time. And you can actually volunteer to be a person on the beach, which I thought was really neat. And just as somebody who's just lying there, you don't have to sing or anything. Right, yeah. So I think there's all these interesting possibilities for the way that opera can make you feel, that I think is almost unique to the genre, in the sense of how immersive it is, and that you're really in this almost like hyperbaric chamber, needing to take all of this in for several hours at a time. And I think that opera can put you into these, like, simulate these states that are actually really speak really, really well to the kind of collective consciousness of the climate crisis. And something else I've been thinking about recently is how well opera can manipulate time. Obviously, operas can be very, very long, but I also think that opera can be really good at making you think about different time scales. And that's something else that we have to be grappling with today as well. You know, we have, as humans, we live maybe like 100 years if we're lucky, or 96 in the case of the Queen,
well,
I guess.
Very lucky.
But, you know, there are lots of other creatures on Earth that live much, much shorter lives than ours, much, much longer. And the Anthropocene asks us to think about the long now, as well as the much, much shorter time periods as well. So, and I think that opera can maybe simulate those different time scales as well. Just musically, the way that opera works, you have to be thinking across vast periods of time, as well as in much, much shorter slices of time as well. Opera can ask you to think in about geological time, potentially, too. I mean, Wagner is somebody who asks you to think in like really, really vast, almost geological scales. Mm. So I think that there's a way for Robert to maybe simulate some of that as well. Although it's obviously, it's far from perfect, but it's maybe a medium that can help us think in those terms at least a little bit in a kind of a microscopic way.
Well, that's very cool. So we always like to ask our guests a little bit about their favorite natural place or places. And you kind of touched on this early on when we were talking. Do you have a favorite natural place? And can you tell us what it sounds like? Do those memories come to mind?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. I think that for me, I would have a few options. They're pretty different. I think that I'd go with Grantchester Meadows near Cambridge, which is where I did my master's degree. And Grantchester is one part of Cambridge that's pretty much, it's not really developed. The land is owned by the university, but it's pretty much undeveloped. And it's basically just cows out there. Mm. And I really like going there with my husband, and we just have a picnic with the cows. And so I really like that. And it's really, yeah, it basically sounds like cows, and it sounds like people having picnics. It's just really like pastoral and quaint, and it's lovely. So I think that that's one. A similar sort of like cow / sheep related place would be over the summer we were in Skye. And I think Skye is another place that feels very empty, and basically you hear wind and sheep, and that's pretty much it. So I think that those would be two choices for me. I think that I also really like redwood forests. They're really, really incredible. And I think that having about 10 years in California has maybe actually think in some ways that Burning Cross, I think, asks people to think about the way that wildfires have affected these landscapes. I mean, you know, if you go to these redwood forests, if I had gone 8 or 9 years ago, they hadn't been affected by the fires in the way that they were in the past few years. So they were like very, very vibrant, and you can really hear a lot of animal bird life going on. And you're just overwhelmed by the size of these trees. And that's, I think, really, it's just really, really powerful. And then more recently, if you even get in to see some of these groves, they've been damaged like beyond belief. And so it sounds completely different. It's really, you know, you really get that silent spring that Burning Cross talks about in these redwood groves, which is really, really sad. But I think those would be a few places that I pick. I don't know. I don't know if Central Park counts as a natural space, but I don't like Central Park, I guess.
It'll do.
Yeah. You're,
it's a great,
important place, natural place.
Yeah,
really.
Exactly. Yeah. It is, especially in its context.
Yeah.
So we've talked a little bit about, and you've alluded to artists portraying futures, and I think just wondering what are you thinking about, like what's your future, what's your next project that you're thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, I'm almost done with my book about Wagner. I have one more chapter that I'm finishing now, and so hopefully that'll be out in probably 2024. It's not due until March of 2023. So hopefully it'll be out in 2024. And beyond that, though, I'm already thinking about two new book projects, one of which is another opera project that would emerge out of the last chapter of my current book. So last chapter of my current book is called Hot Opera, which I think is a pretty cool title. I was proud of that title.
I tend
to struggle with titles, but I thought that was a good one. So I was proud of that one. But it's basically about the relationship between opera and sustainability, which we've been talking about a lot over the past little while. And there, I've been interested in thinking beyond narrative. So we tend to think, when we think about opera, we tend to think about music, about visual effects, and about text. And that's pretty common. It's this kind of just like triad that is what most opera scholars think about. But for when it comes to the opera house, I think what I would want to say in that book, pretty much it's what I say in this last chapter, is that the opera house is a kind of biospheric technology in the sense that it's the very space itself, starting at least in the 17th century, would not have existed at all without some of the processes that put into play the climate crisis. And so it's always been engaging with the climate crisis in one way or another, even if that's not visible on stage. So I've been interested in that particular idea, which builds on this film historian, this guy called Mark Bould, who has this idea called the climate actually, it's the Anthropocene unconscious, but I think I might say the climate unconscious or something, so we're not so tethered to the Anthropocene. But this idea that so much in literature and art and film and music is relevant to thinking about the climate crisis, but in a way that's sort of like one step beyond what's most visible. And I think that's very much true in opera too. The idea that like the opera house itself couldn't have existed without some of these processes, like the slave trade, for instance, in the 17th century, allowed opera houses to be built in London. And that's something that I think I'd want to write about. And also just the relationship between opera companies starting in the 19th century with like major oil and gas companies. So that's been a relationship that's existed for a really long time and continues today. So these kinds of like sublimated relationships between opera and the causes of climate change, these kind of big systemic causes, is something I think I'd want to write about. So that would be one possibility. I'd like to do that. I don't know if it would be the next one, but if not, my second book, third book. And then the other possibility would be a book about the history of the microphone, which I've already written about a little bit. Yeah. So I have an article out called Tectonic Microphonics, which was also, I thought, a good title.
Yeah,
so
what a great title. Like we've got to get you into title some of our stuff.
That's right.
So, and that one is basically about 19th century seismologists who built microphones in the 1870s to listen to earthquakes. And so there were these Italian geologists. They heard about this thing called the microphone, and they said, well, okay, we're going to build these things, and we're going to try to listen for the sounds of the earth moving before an earthquake even happens. Wow. So to try to use them as predictive devices. And they did this at Mount Vesuvius, which I thought was especially interesting. They just like built this little cave under Mount Vesuvius and went in there and listened to Mount Vesuvius. So they were interested in predicting when the next eruption would be, and Gurgling. Also predicting earthquakes. And that was a device that I argue was really essential to modernizing or allowing Italians to seem modern in terms of their scientific sensibilities, because a lot of scientists believe Italians could not be scientists. They believed that if you lived in a part of the world that was seismic, that you couldn't be a scientist, that your brain was sort of like addled by the seismic motion. So British and French and German scientists believed that Italians couldn't be scientists, and they were barbarians, basically, because they lived, that's what they would say. They lived in the seismic part of the world. They thought the same thing about the Japanese. So this was a way for them to kind of push back against that racism at a moment just beyond Italian unification. And it was also coincided, interestingly, with another word for Anthropocene that Italian geologists invented right around the same time as when they invented these microphones, which I thought was a really interesting parallel. So I'd want to do another book, I think a book on the history of the microphone as sort of environmental predictive environmental device. And I've found some interesting stuff about glaciologists using microphones to listen for glaciers calving around 1920, 1930. And there is actually really interesting. There were German glaciologists who listened to glaciers calving. They had these microphones to do that. And then they wanted to film the glaciers calving for movies in Germany. Right. And what their problem though is that it took a while for the glaciers to calve in the way they wanted them to. So what they did, because they didn't want to sit there and wait, is they just blew them up. So they just blew them up with dynamite. They literally just planted dynamite in the glaciers, just blew them up. So, you know, today we're talking about glaciers melting, but in the 20s and 30s, they literally were just blown up for movies.
Wow.
And so they were just filmed and they just blew them up with dynamite. So
magic of the movies.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's another possible chapter. There's also some good stuff from mining engineers and the history of the hydrophone is also interesting. So there's some good possibilities in there too. So I'm not sure which of those two I'd want to do first, but those are definitely two books that I'd like to write in the next couple of years.
Sounds like we'll have to get you back.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Yeah. All right, Kirsten. Well, looking forward to meeting you in person sometime.
Definitely. Likewise. Sounds really good. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Take care.
Take care.
Bye.
I'll talk to you guys later.
So, wasn't that amazing? That was
it's really
was.
There's just really so much in there. What did you take from that?
First of all, I think, and this is a compliment for me, Kirsten is such a scientist, you know, that passion for everything that she does. I love talking to folks that, you know, she can talk about a microphone or talk about sounds or talk about operas. And even if you haven't been there and don't have that background, I love the passion that she brings to it. So that was a lot of fun. Great to talk to her.
Yeah, no, I agree. I thought she was fantastic. Just so interesting. And like you said, the passion and something that I thought that's come up a number of times with different people we've talked to is the importance of being exposed to this kind of thing, science, nature, music, in her case, as a young person, carries through a deeper understanding in later life. And that, you know, that isn't necessarily, I mean, you can pick up things later on, but it does seem to be a recurring theme that people have had some sort of exposure early on. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah. I think some of this, you know, you think about our innate connections with nature that we talk about. Mm. I think sounds fit in there, you know, the discussion of, you know, the soundtrack for a horror film or the sound of a fire alarm. I think that, you know, we kind of find that everybody reacts to those in a way that I think is, you know, part of our genetics and our evolution.
Well, this is something actually that I was thinking about when you were talking about the cartoons. Bugs Bunny could only use those sound effects or those pieces of opera or symphony that they do because they're in a sense archetypes, right? There's something that everybody, including kids, understand, and why it works for Star Wars with John Williams is because even if you've never been exposed to that, those kinds of sounds are going to evoke certain sort of relationships or certain sort of emotions. And to me, what makes those Bugs Bunny things funny, and I do love like that. Do you remember What's Opera, Doc? That was amazing. So is juxtaposing this really dramatic music with really inappropriate cartoon content. Like it's just amazing. They were so talented, those guys.
I also really like the discussion of soundscapes and sort of nature sounds, letting nature, I think you said, speak for itself in some cases. Right. But then in others where it's more of an interpretation or we, you know, we make music, we make sounds to transport people to these environments and to these places versus, you know, letting nature speak for itself.
And that's one of the things that is actually so brilliant. You know, well, I mean, obviously composers have a lot of genius behind what they do. But thinking about the people who are capturing sound, like Bernie Krause, who we've talked to and talked about, is finding those elements in nature that evoke certain emotions by themselves, right? Instead of constructing something like Wagner does to elicit a certain kind of emotion, or again, John Williams, you're finding something in nature that does it by itself and getting back to that idea of archetypes, where in theory, it's something that we all connect to. It goes deeper, like you said about genetics. It's something that no matter who you are, where you're from, you react to it in the exact same way.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Well, that was great. I look forward to hearing more from Kirsten and all her projects.
Yes. Same.
Thank you for listening to Love Nature. Check back for our next episode where we speak with author and science journalist Christy Hamilton. It will be a great episode. Please subscribe to Love Nature so you never miss an episode. You can find Love Nature at love-nature.org, and you can explore our museum at naturalsciences.org. All of the links mentioned in the show can be found at the aforementioned love-nature.org. Love Nature is a production of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, located in beautiful downtown Raleigh, North Carolina.